യോഗേണ ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാദ് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So we are continuing this discussion on what we call restraining the vrittis. The discussion continues. It's one of the most important, maybe the very crucial part of the whole text. So we have to remember there are 5 types of vrittis: pramana, viparya, vikalpa, nidra, smriteha. In general, we can say whatever we do, we speak, we think, we act, or even if flash of idea in our mind will create a residual effect in our mental system, which later on becomes a natural tendency, an attitude, an emotional approach, which may manifest or express in our character, determining, deciding how we respond to different situations from external world, and also how we respond to our own internal experiences like happiness, unhappiness, anxiety, and so on. So the subtle effect of all these will create what could be called our personality. Not the physical personality, but personality that could be defined as the totality of our attitudes, approaches, emotions, feelings, and responses to different situations. And very often, these vrittis are not friendly. These tendencies may not always be friendly. So Patanjali himself divides these vrittis into 2 categories: those which are friendly, which are helpful, and those which are not so very helpful. One practical example that we discussed many times earlier is this. Very often we want to do some noble deeds. We sometimes want to bring about a change in our pattern of life. When we get inspiration from reading a book or listening to something, we want to start a new habit. And we may have a strong, sincere desire to do that. But then when we actually try to do, there is an invisible mental block that seems to prevent us from doing it. So that mental block that prevents us from undertaking anything that is noble or elevating is the influence or the pull of negative tendencies, which are the abstract or subtle forms, subtle residual effects of ideas or attitudes or actions that we may have done. Maybe not so very good actions, so not so very good ideas or thought currents, which create a kind of negative, a group of negative tendencies, residual effects in the mental system. And as we go on consciously making effort to do noble deeds, then this conflict gets reduced because we are accumulating positive tendencies, positive vrittis, healthy vrittis. And as we advance further, we feel less and less conflict because the totality of healthy tendencies, healthy vrittis, spiritually friendly tendencies becomes much more. They increase, and proportionately the amount of unhealthy tendencies will decrease. Now Patanjali, as I mentioned, so I'm just summing up what we discussed during the last several sessions. So Patanjali gives a method of restraining, controlling the impact of negative tendencies, negative actions. So he says, Abhyasa Vairagyabhyam Tat Nirodhaka. In fact, this is the whole purpose of yoga. Yoga as a philosophical, psychological, spiritual mechanism is all about controlling or restraining the effect or the impact of negative vrittis. That is yogaka chitta vritti nirodhaka. That is a definition of yoga. Yoga is nothing but the art and the science and the method of restraining vrittis. So, and he said there are two methods, abhyasa and vairagya, repeated effort. And this repeated effort should be guided by a mechanism which is called in Sanskrit vairagya. It means non-attachment or detachment, which in the language of psychology we can say when an unhealthy thought current, a vritti, appears, we should not befriend them, we should not accommodate, we should not be friendly, we should not accommodate that negative tendencies, and we should not antagonize them. Because we cannot really fight with our mind. You can fight with anything, but mind you cannot fight with. Mind you can control your mind by giving our mental system a healthy channel, by giving a healthy orientation. So what we actually call controlling the mind is nothing but giving the mind healthy food. And as the healthy food for the mind means healthy vrittis. So this vritti is a very important word. I don't think we can translate that word into English. Impossible. So most of the reliable translations repeat the word vritti because it has become almost a technical term which cannot really be translated without speaking for a long time to explain its different implications. So vritti in a way is a residual effect of whatever we do, whatever we think, whatever we act. Its immediate effect is visible, tangible, but it is remote impact because it registers a tendency in the mental system. And that tendency will essentially become part of our character, and it will determine how we live, what attitudes we develop in our mind. Now, how this actually happens, we will discuss and then we will continue the next sutra. So normally, of course, this is very crucial to understand the meaning of the next sutra. So when we go through different experiences, either experiences that may connect us to external objects, or experiences which are responses to our own inner feelings and emotions, like, see, happiness, unhappiness, pain, depression, joy, all these, how we respond to these inner experiences, and also how we respond to experiences that are connected to some external objects or persons, two types of experiences. We respond to these experiences either as extreme attachment, extreme liking, or its opposite, extreme aversion, extreme dislike, or total indifference. These are three types of mental responses to experiences, inner or outer experiences. Now, in those experiences where an external object is involved, our mind and any of the five senses of perception come together and will connect, and as a result, we go through an experience. For example, when we see a picture, seeing a picture, or hearing a word, or whatever it may be, a music, or a great picture, anything, or a beautiful smell. These are all experiences in which our mind and the five senses of perception are involved. Taste, sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of sight, and sense of hearing. All these five senses of perception and mind are involved. Mind and eyes come together and focus on a visual object, and that experience of seeing a visual object will register an impact in the mental system. Depending upon the type of what we see or what we hear, it may leave in our mind a response mechanism, either extreme aversion or extreme liking or a kind of indifference. Depending upon the power with which that experience happens, the impact will remain as a strongly registered effect in the mental system. This later becomes a vritti, and Vedanta and Yoga says, and Buddhist tradition also says, this is not related to this life alone. Many experiences, many maybe phobias, obsessions, irrational likes or dislikes, attitudes which have no reasonable psychologically, psychologically scientific explanations based on experiences in this life. They may have a cause. So that cause from previous life experiences. So that's an important point to understand, and something we should always remember when we understand yoga psychology. The concept of reincarnation, the idea that death is not the end of life, death is only what we may call a semicolon or a comma, not a full stop. Death is not the end of human life. Death is only a transition where the subtle body leaves behind one kind of physical body and will adopt another physical mechanism, which is called rebirth. And again, the doctrine of law of karma. These are two fundamental cardinal principles which should be kept in mind when we discuss yoga, Vedanta, or Buddhism and many other oriental traditions. So Patanjali says, if we practice non-attachment, which is called vairagya in Patanjali's language, then we will be able to get out of this trap of or the stranglehold of the tyranny of unhealthy tendencies, unhealthy vrittis, unhealthy residual effects of our character, of our previous actions. Neither through antagonizing nor through befriending, keeping ourselves as witnesses through by a practice of being totally indifferent. Total indifference is the essence of this non-attachment. And the last two sutras, he discussed two types of detachment. That is 15th and 16th sutra. In the 15th sutra, you know, drishta anusraviga vishaya vidrishnasya vashikara samya vairagyam. That is the first, what is called, it is first means the first stage of practicing this non-attachment. The highest non-attachment comes in the next sutra. This is the secondary here means the first stage in developing this non-attachment attitude. In short, it means a kind of dispassion, which is freedom from craving for any kind of pleasures, either in this life or next life. So even if you do certain things expecting that we'll get the result after death, that also may influence our actions, and frequently that influence manifests in the form of disappointment or depression. So total freedom from desire, total freedom from any kind of desire for pleasures. Now, how do we actually achieve this? That means how to look upon happiness itself as something not very desirable. It is very difficult. We are all looking for happiness. Now, the point is, of course, here happiness should be understood. Happiness in its purely worldly or empirical sense. I mean, happiness that we normally enjoy when we get something that we want, either money, wealth, status, anything that we have a strong desire for. When we achieve that, we feel a kind of content, a kind of joy. That is happiness. So it is not any kind of spiritual happiness or divine contentment, nothing like that. Happiness in its purely empirical, worldly sense. We should be totally freedom from this. So, happiness itself is not a very happy state of affairs, because happiness related to any kind of temporary achievement will be automatically followed by its opposite, because whatever makes us happy in a very empirical sense, worldly sense, will become unhappiness, because any worldly achievement is impermanent. What makes us happy today can be the cause of unhappiness because we may lose it tomorrow. So, happiness in the worldly sense is not real permanent happiness. It is only a temporary absence of unhappiness. That's what it is. So success itself, in the worldly sense, is not so much desirable. It doesn't mean that we should not work for success. If we can work for success, if we can work for happiness, even worldly happiness, after fully realizing the fact, the worldly happiness cannot be a permanent state of happiness. It will quickly become unhappiness. Once we understand this, and if we work for happiness, then if an unhappy situation comes, it will not make us unhappy. That means our perspective, our approach, our attitude towards life as a whole goes beyond an obsession for happiness and success. So this, Patanjali says, should not be limited to desirable things in this world. So we should not have any desire for anything. In fact, the source of real happiness is going beyond desire for happiness. The real success comes when you transcend your desire for success. Because success cannot be a permanent state of affairs. Every success will be followed by its opposite, or something other than success, which could be only failure. So once we understand and then work for success, once we understand the limitation of worldly happiness and then work for happiness, then we will be happy in the true sense of the word, because we will be able to go beyond the worldly concepts of happiness and unhappiness equation. That's why one famous verse which Gandhi used to quote again and again. There's a reason why I quote Gandhiji. See, Gandhiji was a saintly person, but he was not a monk, but he was as great as any monk, of course. Conventionally, he was not a saint, but he was as great as any saint. He was a politician, he was a lawyer, worked in this world, worked for a country, led people against the ruling government. That's not what we expect a saint to be busy doing, agitating people, leading a big agitation in the streets. That's not what we expect. But this Gandhi made one interesting statement. He says, if all the world scriptures vanish from this world, if one Upanishad, one very small Vedantic text, it's called Isavasya Upanishad, if the first verse of that text remains, that would be enough for fulfilling all human aspirations. The verse is the first verse of Isavasya Upanishad. The verse is very simple. Isavasya midam sarvam yat kinja jagatyam jagat tena tektena bunjithaha ma grudhak kasya siddhanam. It's a simple verse. In fact, Isavasya Upanishad is not even the most important Upanishad, Vedantic text. In fact, there are much more important Vedantic texts like Gita, Brihadaranyaka, Chandrika Upanishads. But Gandhi believed, Gandhi was a practical man, really not a Sanskrit scholar in a conventional sense. He knew a little Sanskrit. But he was a great saint who lived many of these ideas, explained, described in these books, great spiritual books. So he said, if this verse remains in human memory, that will be enough for fulfilling the highest human aspirations. That brings out this idea. The verse, as I mentioned, the first part of the verse is, the whole world is enveloped, covered by the presence of the divine. So God is an all-pervading divine reality. And the whole world, the whole existence, everything in this world is enveloped, covered by the presence of the divine. This is the first part of the verse. The second part, then how to live in this world? That's the next subject. You make a great declaration that everything in this world is covered by the presence of the divine, the presence of God. Then how to live in this world? Then he tena tyaktena bunjitaha ma krutak kasya siddhanam. So the world doesn't belong to you. So it belongs to the higher divine reality. So if it doesn't belong to you, how will you enjoy living this world? So he says, tena tyaktena bunjitaha. So you enjoy the world by renouncing it. That's how the language, the verse puts it. How to renounce? How to enjoy this world by renouncing it? He says, by keeping in mind that world as such doesn't belong to you, it is pervaded, it is enveloped by the presence of the divine reality. Keep this in mind and then live in this world. So keeping this in mind, you will renounce, give up through dispassion and detachment. Vairagya is the word Patanjali uses. You give up all your extreme obsession, obsessive attachment to worldly pleasures, empirical pleasures, and you give up. And then you live in this world, enjoy it. So renunciation becomes a method of enjoying this world. That's the meaning of the word. Gandhi says, this is enough. These two ideas are enough for humanity to reach the highest spiritual aspirations, Gandhi said. So that's the theme of the 15th verse. We discussed this earlier. That means total dispassion for things that we see, things that we encounter in our everyday life, and also for those things that we may not see, that we may hear, we may read about, we may aspire for, not readily available in front of you. So total freedom from any kind of craving, any desire, any obsessive attachment towards these worldly things. Once you achieve this, that is the first stage towards reaching this detachment. So the whole idea of detachment becomes a great philosophical system. In its most practical level, Patanjali himself says, Patanjali doesn't go as far as Gandhi, of course, in explaining the philosophical aspect of detachment. Patanjali says, when we try to do a good deed, when we try to meditate or when we try to pray and when we try to do a noble deed or when we try to change the paradigm of our life to something higher, more elevating. And if there is a problem manifesting in the form of a conflicting thought, mind not cooperating, mind snatching us away from what we actually want to do, then you adopt this attitude of vairagya, means detachment. So detachment is not a negative mental mechanism. Detachment is a very healthy and psychologically very rational attitude towards conflicting ideas that may emerge in our mind, that may prevent us from doing what we actually want to do. Because, as I mentioned earlier, we have very little control over the thoughts in our mind. But we may have more control over what we do with our senses of action. But we have very little control over these mental thought currents. So mind should be attached to this ideal of detachment. Means sit there, watch your own mind, watch the thought currents that emerge in the mind. Don't fight with them, but do not befriend them either. Then they will stop troubling you. That is the method explained in the 15th sutra. We already discussed. So the 16th sutra deals with the higher detachment, the superior kind of detachment. Chattatparam purushakhyadehi gunavaitrishnyam. This is the sutra. That is the 16th sutra. So first we develop a total dispassion towards any cravings or desires. And at a later stage, we intensify this dispassion. So when we first practice dispassion for cravings, I mentioned earlier, it's like we are putting a seed in an environment when there is no water. A lot of weeds and grass, so the seed cannot grow. So by practicing this detachment or renunciation, dispassion, we are preventing our natural desires for worldly things from manifesting. But their potential ability to become a strong desire is not fully destroyed. That happens when you practice this higher renunciation, this higher dispassion. I am using the word renunciation, you know. Here renunciation should be understood in its ordinary sense. Renunciation of extreme desire or obsessive desire for enjoying worldly comforts. Obsession with worldly happiness, obsession with the idea that the goal of human life is success. Actual practical means extreme obsession with the idea of success. So we should not misunderstand this, which is very important. It is not a pessimistic idea. It doesn't mean that you should not work for success, you should not work for happiness. Not at all. So once we understand that work for happiness doesn't bring happiness very often. Very often it may bring happiness, but that happiness may turn out to be unhappiness when the cause of happiness disappears. A lot of money may make a person happy. If the bank collapses, if he becomes a bankrupt person, then that becomes unhappiness. Money itself becomes, the wealth itself becomes the cause of unhappiness. So once we understand that extreme obsession with the ideal of happiness or success can itself become a cause of unhappiness or its opposite, I mean, or the opposite of success, then what happens? We should start thinking of a higher paradigm that goes beyond happiness and success. Not failure or unhappiness, rather, our approach should transcend the lower levels of obsession with happiness or success. Then what happens, you know, is we get out of this this trap of unhealthy thought currents. But then this is only first stage. At a higher stage, what happens? It's like a seed that is burned. So that is a you find here in this in these commentaries, you find such ideas. A seed that is fried in oil and which you have kept in a plate for eating on the table, dining hall, it doesn't sprout if you put it in even the most fertile soil. So there's a higher kind of dispassion, a higher superior type of freedom from desire, which means even the very idea, even the very idea of attachment or desire, worldly enjoyments, totally disappears. That comes at the more advanced state of practicing dispassion. First, desire becomes weakened, rather it for some time disappears, but it doesn't potentially get completely removed. As I mentioned, you know, if you take the example of a seed of desire, let us say, seed of obsession for success or happiness, worldly success. You have a desire for it, but through reading scriptures, through practice, we philosophically we understand the importance of going beyond this obsession for worldly success or worldly pleasures. And then what happens, you know, very often we will be able to keep our balance, our poise intact when a problem arises. So success and failure, both are two sides of the same coin. Life cannot be exclusively a journey for success. Life can also have failures. This you understand. So you develop a kind of dispassion for success or happiness, let us say. But it's like a seed which is not completely destroyed. Its potential, its potency is not destroyed. But you have kept the seed in a place where there is not fertile, it's not a fertile soil, a plenty of weeds and grass. So it cannot sprout. The desire cannot sprout. The desire cannot become an extreme obsession, creating anxieties, creating unhappiness when we are not able to achieve what we desire for. The first stage. Second stage is, the seed is fried in an oven, let us say. The comparison, I'm giving an illustration. The second kind of dispassion is much higher. It completely wipes out even the remote possibility of our falling a prey to extreme desires, empirical pleasures, empirical desires. So it's like a seed that is fried. You put in a fertile soil, nothing will happen. It will degenerate, it will vanish. So that is the second type of higher dispassion is discussed in the 16th sutra. Tatparam purushakhyadehe gunavaidrishnyam. That means non-attachment or dispassion not only for success or desirable objects, but even the very idea of attachment, the very idea that worldly pleasures is the only goal of human life, that completely vanishes. That is the second state of this detachment. So Vyasa, you know, the great commentator says, Tasyam viraktam chittam tamabhikhyadim nirunathi. What happens, you know, when the mind is completely detached from even the idea, even the very concept of worldly enjoyments, then what happens? It is called highest renunciation, highest dispassion. So now, today we had to discuss the 17th sutra, because we discussed 15th and 16th already in the last few sessions. 17th sutra is very important. Now you have to remember, we are entering a new phase in the discussion of yoga psychology and yoga philosophy. So till this sutra, I mean 16th sutra, we are discussing yoga in general. Now Patanjali discusses different concepts of samadhi, higher concentration is discussed here. And that is very important. You may have heard of yogis acquiring occult powers. When we read about it, we have many exotic, very often irrational ideas about this. There is nothing occult about it. Once you understand Patanjali's system, you will understand it's purely scientific. Just as when you exercise your body, physical body, the physical body itself will produce many special powers, many extraordinary skills, as you can see in the lives of athletes, martial artists, and so on. Higher skills at the physical level, bodily level, you can find it. So now, suppose you exercise your mind, your thoughts, your ability to concentrate. Then, just as the body develops higher skills through constant practice, scientific practice, then mind also develops such skills, such powers. So, maybe most of you must have read, at least some of you have read, The Life of Vivekananda. It happened in London. Swami, you know, some of Swamiji's disciples, they in their presence, Swamiji read, the early, maybe 1954th edition, maybe 64th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And so there were many topics which Vivekananda was not familiar with. He was a monk, and he must have been 34, 35 years of age at that time. Maybe 34 or 35. So, he read some pages, and then he was turning pages faster than normal people do. So people asked him, Swamiji, could you understand all this? Then he asked them, you can ask any question from those pages which I read. And they asked questions, and Vivekananda could give the answer. He said, now, there is nothing occult about it. So we have to remember, first of all, when you read in newspapers or when you read yoga books, a person has some kind of special occult powers, should never believe. Because yoga is pure science. Yoga is pure science. There is nothing that is occult. It is nothing that cannot be scientifically explained in yoga. That's an extraordinary aspect of Patanjali's system. It's pure science. Now, how do we, then what about these skills? When you do not understand the scientific method behind, then you call it a miracle. That's what really happens. So, miracle is a word we use. So, occult is a word we use when we are not able to understand or explain something with the available tools available to us, which may be very limited. And then when we read something, it is something which is occult, which is... In yoga, there is nothing that you may call miracle or a miraculous. There is nothing occult. It's all purely scientific, scientifically verifiable facts. I can explain this. Even Vivekananda's experience, we can explain in the language of Patanjali system, yoga. What is meant by concentration? What's meant by reading? Let us say, suppose you are sitting there reading a book. Okay. Now, your eyes and mind come together and they focus on a word and you understand the meaning of the word based on your previous knowledge. Because knowing is connecting the unknown with the known with the unknown. That's knowledge. That's how you from a known territory, you go to the territory of the unknown. That's called knowledge. Now, when you sit on a chair and hold a book in your hand, when you read, and you understand it, you may not remember what you read even 5 minutes later. Why? So Patanjali will explain this in a very rational, scientific manner. The reason is this. When you're reading that book, when your eyes were focused on the word which you are reading, your hand was touching the book. So part of the mind was driven through the sense of touch. Because you're holding the book in your hand, you're aware that you're holding the book in your hand. That means a fraction of the mind is taken away by the sense of touch. And even while reading or listening, you may also be listening to the sound coming from the street. A car making sound in the street, you are hearing that also. So part of the mind is taken away by the sense of hearing. And if there is the incense sticks, smell coming from the shrine, a sense of smell also will drag the mind away from what you are trying to listen, and it will drag your mind to the objects from where this smell is coming. And if you are chewing gum, then sense of taste also will drag a fraction of the mental energy and focus to the chewing gum and its wonderful taste. And even while reading the book, when the eyes are focused on the word, you may also be mentally seeing the other things, because seeing or hearing is not purely related to senses. It could happen even without the help of senses. You listen to your music in the morning and evening, you remember and you repeat it, and you are hearing again, but not at the sensory level. You are hearing it at the mental level. You saw a picture in the art gallery. 10 years later, you may be seeing again. If you're a painter, you'd be able to see clearly. You may be able to reproduce something like that, because you're seeing the picture again, though you saw the picture actually with your eyes only 10 years back. But if you're a painter, you'd be able to see it again mentally and you draw a picture. So sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of hearing, sense of all this, taste, everything is not necessary for you to remember, to re-experience what you have experienced in previous life. So what a yogi does is, somebody trained in yoga, when he reads something like Vivekananda reading the Encyclopedia Britannica, what he did, you know, his whole mind was focused on what he was reading. So you won't forget it. Just one focus, one reading is enough for such persons to remember it permanently. You know, all the great philosophical books of Vedantic tradition were brought to light by Shankaracharya, who lived only for 32 years. And he studied all the scriptures, all the four Vedas, Buddhism, everything before he was 7 years old. And he wrote the most profound philosophical texts in Vedantic tradition before he was 16 years old. And he founded hundreds of temples. He is also the author of the most exquisite, beautiful devotional poetry in Sanskrit language. Apart from being the greatest philosopher and the founder of no less than 10 monastic orders, and he passed away when he was less than 32 years old. And you know about Shankaracharya, Sister Niveda wrote in this Web of Indian Life. She says, she gives an example. Sister Niveda was Miss Margaret Noble, a highly educated, a firebrand Irish social worker, social reformer, and a great educationist who became a great Vedantin as a disciple of Vivekananda. She became one of the greatest Vedantins born in Western Hemisphere. Sister Niveda writes about Shankaracharya. He says he's a combination of Ignatius Loyola. He founded only Jesuit order. And he was a combination of Augustine, Aquinas, St. Paul, mind you, because he wrote the most profound theological, philosophical books in Vedanta, wrote most wonderful poetry in Indian tradition, founded hundreds of temples, developed all that is that we can be proud of in Veda, Indian philosophical tradition, and everything within 32 years. And Gandhi, again, he says, what the great Shankara achieved within a short lifespan of 32 years, the British Empire could not undo in 190 years. British Empire from 1757 Battle of Plassey to 1947, the year India got independence, 190 years. They were trying to undo whatever Shankara did in 8th century, that Gandhi says, because of yoga. So, great spiritual persons, what they do, they develop their mind into a very sharp, highly refined instrument and make use of it for the good of humanity. Now, this is possible only when we get total freedom from the pull of material objects or worldly objects. So, it is called Samprajnata Samadhi and Asamprajnata Samadhi. So we are going to discuss this in the coming sutras. In fact, from now onwards, we start some of the most important themes in the yoga system. I mean, different kinds of concentrations and the techniques of concentrations and the mystery of what we normally, by mistake, call occult powers, which are really not occult, which are the result of making use of this wonderful method of concentration of the mind and how mind develops some unique powers. This first sutra is very important. Vitarka vichara ananda asmita anugama samprajnata. This is the first sutra. First sutra in this particular section dealing with the different types of samadhi. So what it means in short is this. So we don't have time to discuss the whole thing today, but just a bird view. So the samprajnata yoga or samprajnata samadhi, which is a means to get control over the material world and its objects and its influences or what you call temptations, whatever it is. How to master the working of the human mind by concentrating on, by developing higher powers of concentration of the mind. So this samprajnata yoga is that which is accompanied by reasoning. At that stage, we get control over gross objects and vichara. So that's called vitarka and vichara ananda asmita anugama. This is a sutra. I shall explain this. I know that when you read the sutra in the text, the idea may not become clear. But as we discuss, you'll understand. As we develop higher powers of concentration, we will be able to understand the real meaning and the real dimension, the real picture of whatever we see in this material world. And also, we will be able to understand the reality beyond the material. We will be able to understand the transcendental reality, the transcendental dimension of what we see at the empirical level. This is the meaning. We will continue this discussion. We do not have time to discuss this very important sutra today for want of time, because once we start, then we cannot, it may take a long time. So we will continue this discussion in the next class. Now we can have interactions. Those of you who want to ask questions, most welcome.
You talk about the frying of the seed, so that the seed will not sprout again. How does the frying occur in real life?
Yeah, yeah. Real life, we first we understand the real problems, the real difficulties we encounter by keeping our mind attached to all these worldly things. Because rationally, if you analyze this attachment, obsessive attachment, desire for things, eventually land us in trouble. But whatever we desire for, we don't achieve. So every desire is automatically followed by some unhappy experience. It's impossible for everyone to have all that he or she may have desired for. So through this reasoning, we try to weaken our desire for things, the first stage. That's here the seed is not burnt, it is not fried, but it is kept non-functional. Like putting a seed in a dry soil where there is no water, nothing. Now, how to make it intense? Now, as we develop this primary, the first stage of detachment, by understanding that every kind of desire will lead us into some unhappy experience, gradually what we understand, you know, the total freedom from unhappiness comes only when you give up your desire for happiness. Total freedom from unhappiness is possible only when we transcend happiness-unhappiness equation. So that means the mind goes beyond happiness-unhappiness equation. So you will be able to look upon the so-called unhappy experience with the same attitude with which you approach a happy experience. So far as you are concerned, happiness-unhappiness equation doesn't exist. Keep your mind in a state of perfect equilibrium. The mind transcends these duels of happiness and unhappiness, pain, pleasure, success, failure, etc. That's the highest stage of dispassion. Then even if something unhappy happens, you won't be shocked. Because your mind is not after happiness. So why should an unhappy event make you unhappy? You are not happy when a happy, good event occurs. So you won't be unhappy when its opposite happens. If you are happy when a pleasant experience occurs, then we'll be totally unhappy when an unpleasant experience, an unpleasant event occurs. So freedom from desire for happiness, when it reaches its perfection, then we get out of our tendency to become unhappy when something unpleasant happens. That's how we transcend happiness-unhappiness equation, duels. If you have the least desire for a happy event, a pleasant experience, if you get overjoyed when something happy happens, when a pleasant experience happens, then there is no doubt we will be unhappy when its opposite happens. So the only way to get out of this trap, the problem of unhappiness, is not look for happiness, which means if we go beyond both. This happens through constant practice, and also even intellectually, if we keep ourselves familiar with these ideas and try to analyze our life and world in general from this higher perspective, then we can remain in state of perfect equilibrium, equipoise. whether we are experiencing the pleasant or the unpleasant things. That's the only thing. I mean, the only way to get out of unhappiness is not to look for happiness. The only way to be happy is not looking for happiness. The only way to remain unaffected by failure is stop looking for success. It doesn't mean that we must stop working for success. It doesn't mean that we must stop working for happiness. But if you can work for happiness, but keep in mind, perpetual happiness is impossible. You should also keep in mind the fact that the only way out of unhappiness is to stop looking for happiness. That's why, you know, the paradoxical statement, you should enjoy the world through renouncing it. That is the statement in the Upanishad Gandhi used to repeat again. You enjoy this world not by enjoying this world, but by giving up desire for enjoyment. In fact, that helps you to enjoy in a much more healthy, rational manner. The other enjoyment will be only prelude to unhappiness. That's the thing. Okay. You wanted to answer?
Yes, sir. Good evening, sir. In Rama, Tulasidasa's Rama,
Dhammacharitamanas.
Yes, sir. There's a in beginning that name and object are one, and by repeating Rama's name, you can get the miraculous powers.
Yeah.
Would that be something that Patanjali would agree with? And could you elaborate on that? Is that correct, sir?
Yeah. You know, Patanjali, the Samadhipada, he says, Ishar Pridhanatva. I can explain this. The beginning of the first chapter, the printed book, it's called Samadhipada, on concentration. The first Patanjali explains Yamas and Niyamas, two sets of disciplines. Yamas, Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Aparigraha, non-violence, non-stealing, not having any desire for possessions, and then niyama mean purity, contentment, and so on, pure life, and so on. So you should practice all these disciplines before you step into the path of yoga. Before you start pranayama, asana, whatever it is, you should make your mind ready for facing the changes that occurs in your mind or to your body when you start yogasana, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, etc. Then Patanjali makes one statement in that context. Says, suppose you cannot practice these disciplines. If you resign yourself completely to the will of God, then that is enough. Because if you completely resign yourself to the will of God, so Ishara Pranidhanatva, that is a sutra. Or through complete resignation to the will of God. If you can think of God as help, as guiding you in every thought, in every deed, in whatever you do, whatever you speak, if you can bring the God idea, the presence of God, the idea of God, into whatever you do, whatever you speak, whatever you think, then all these disciplines like non-violence, self-restraint, self-control, inner purity, all this will become naturally, will come to you. That is a higher state. So all these qualities that Patanjali speaks of will become automatically, will come to you automatically if you can bring God into your life every moment, into every thought, every deed, and every word. That is fine. But remember, this is from a general perspective. Patanjali himself doesn't go that far. Because Patanjali's system, it doesn't agree with the devotional philosophy of Tulasidasi Ramacharitamanas. It follow find. It doesn't mean that Patanjali is wrong or Tulasidasi right or somebody is wrong, somebody right. It's a different approach to spiritual life. You follow? Patanjali's system is a different approach to spiritual life. It focuses on inner mind control, our controlling our ideas, our thoughts, and practice of mental restraint. That's what Patanjali is focusing on. Tulasidasi is focusing on something higher for a devotee. Even if he can't practice all these disciplines automatically, if he can take the name of Rama, the name of God, or any, if he can bring into your life every moment, it into every deed, every word, the presence of God, then all these purity of mind, all the yamas, niyamas, they become automatically come to us. Follow?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I just want to share a little thought. The less you desire, the more you receive. Thank you.
Yeah. And if you can be free from desire, then you will have the mental health to enjoy what you have got. You will have the psychological health to live and enjoy if you are free from desire. If you are not free from desire, then even if you get what you desired for, you won't have the mental health to enjoy. Because desire is, it won't come to an end. It's like a burning fire. You pour more and more ghee into it. You can't put out fire by pouring more ghee into it. So freedom from desire is the best way to enjoy this world. That's what the Upanishad says. Patanjali doesn't go to that sort of higher metaphysics. You know, he comes down to you, to our level, and he tells us how our thought, our deeds, our ordinary mechanical thoughts and ideas and emotions, how they influence our life and how to control. He's almost like a behavioral scientist. Many of these ideas even go beyond many of the basic principles in modern psychology. For example, Patanjali makes it a point, it's very interesting, he says, if you don't have anything else to do, go on trying to do good deeds, even if you don't succeed. In your mind, if you have a desire to do good deeds, even if you are not able to do good deeds, that desire itself will produce a good vritti in the mind. You may not be able to do that, but even having a sincere desire for good ideas, good thoughts, good actions, itself will be a spiritual practice. So it's rational it is. Okay. Yeah.
So last time we discussed about the spiritual path, and you said like it has to be taken at the right age of your time, and if you take at the time when you are not physically active or you are old, and at that time you think of detachment, then it does not benefit you. So can you elaborate that more?
You can see both these examples. Those who may not have bothered much about spiritual life during the early part of their life, when they go too old of retirement, suddenly they come to know that they have, and they forgot, they didn't care for some of the fundamental aspects of human life. That if there is a real strong feeling, that feeling itself will be enough to transform their life. There are some stories about people who had a great transformation in the evening of their lifetime. But if there is the sincere, real feeling of repentance for having neglected higher spiritual values during the early part of their life, the sincerity of that repentance itself will produce all the necessary qualities for starting a new life. the whole life, not only physical life, mental life, everything gets overturned because sincerity. I think of St. Augustine, many people, you know, Christian, St. Francis of Assisi. Of course, Tulsidas himself, he mentioned, you know, Tulsidas is a worldly minded man. And his own wife told him, you are so much attached to these physical, worldly pleasures. If you can devote a fraction of this attachment to God, you'll become a saint. That was enough for him to start a new life. Because that thrusting, that had a thrusting effect on him, that pierced through his emotional, mental system. And he became a different man from that moment onwards. So there's no gradual process. So that happens. Intensity of that experience can produce all the necessary ingredients in the mental system to start a new life. That you find in the lives of many great mystics in all traditions, in Christian tradition, in Vedantic tradition, Hindu tradition, you find all this. Okay, so thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.